Child sex abuse is becoming more prevalent because of technology, but the laws may be catching up to help. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. More child sex predators are finding their victims within online chat rooms and video games. They lure kids in with gifts, then threaten them after receiving damaging photos or texts. This practice is known as sextortion.
The problem with the virtual playground is that, of course, you don't know who's talking to your kids, and you don't know what they're saying to them.
We'll hear about the sorts of things parents can do to protect their children. Also, in many states, there are statute of limitation laws for victims of child sex abuse. That's changing, and it could help victims of cases against Jeffrey Epstein, the Catholic Church, and more. We'll learn how the landscape is changing in Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Sexual predators have found an easy access point into the lives of children. They're scrolling through Facebook or Instagram to find their next victims, or they're logging online and chatting through video games. It'll start with a simple interaction, a hi, or let's play together, and then quickly escalates into something these connections right into their victims' personal lives. And many of these interactions lead to crimes known as sextortion. Today's program is focused on the issues of child sex abuse. Mary Ann Franks is a professor at the University of Miami School of Law and the president of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. That's a nonprofit group dedicated to combating online abuse. If you're a parent who's concerned about who your child communicates with online and if it's safe, send us a note, send us a question. You can connect with us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial or email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. Now, before we get into the conversation, a reminder that the content we're about to hear might be disturbing to some listeners. Ms. Franks, predators will engage in practice known as sextortion. Let's again explain what that is and exactly how does it work.
So the word sextortion covers kind of a lot of range of behaviors, but essentially it is the use of sexual imagery or the coercion of sexual imagery or activity in kind of an attempt to get usually a minor, but it can also be an adult victim, to produce other sexual imagery or to perform sexual activity. And there's usually some sense of taking something incriminating, let's say a topless photo, and then explaining to this particular target that if you don't give me more of this type of content or don't do what I tell you to do, I will take this incriminating content and I will give it to your parents or to your school or something of that nature.
Do these predators target specific age groups or demographics? I mean, you said it could be any age.
Truly, it can be any age. We're certainly seeing that it happens to adults, it happens to men, it happens to women, but we definitely are seeing that there is at least a certain kind of predator who focuses on minors, maybe because that is their sexual preference or also because it is easier to isolate and to exploit minors in many cases.
So the internet has provided really this new tool for predators to connect with their victims. And specifically, because in part of this conversation we wanted to have is we're looking at video games. These online games have chat rooms, they have chat capability, so players can talk to each other. This is where predators are basically able to now connect with kids, right?
Yes. I mean, they're able to connect with any number of people, but yes, it is one of those major kinds of activities that obviously attracts a lot of young people.
When they start chatting with a child in one of these chat rooms, playing one of these games, how do they lure them in? What's their process?
Well, there's multiple ways that you can start the process of grooming or exploiting a minor, but some of the most common ways are to first bond with the target over the game. Just talk about the activities that you're participating in, establish some trust and connection, very often pretend to be a peer of that person, someone in the same age group. And then really one of the most interesting things and troubling things that happens is what we know is that a lot of minors who play these games will then engage in conversations about how they feel about their self-esteem or the experiences they're having at home or at school. and revealing kind of a lot of information about their vulnerabilities, which the person who is attempting to exploit them will then be able to use against them.
And you said this word grooming. I'm picturing how that exactly works.
Well, so the term grooming here may be a bit too specific, but it's really the idea that you are setting someone up to be exploited. That is, you are trying to figure out ways to make them vulnerable so that when you do have the request to send naked pictures or to perform certain sexual acts, you will have a context in which this person has either trusted you or you put them in a position where they feel compromised and isolated and can't tell an adult or someone else what's actually going on.
Do we have any sense of how prevalent this activity is in these game chat rooms?
We have some sense, but they are based on reports that, you know, eventually have to make their way outside of these forums. And so one of the things that these investigative reports have been doing is to try to throw some light on that situation. But the really troubling thing here is, of course, we're not hearing about a lot of the incidents because many times, especially minors, again, will never tell anybody. And so we don't have a really good sense of just how often this is happening on these platforms.
There was a recent New York Times investigation into this, and they found a number of these child sextortion cases. They went through the text messages between the child victims and these predators. And we got to see how quickly an interaction can escalate into something that becomes sexual. What are some of the forms to de-escalate this situation? What's recommended for parents and kids?
Well, this is an incredibly difficult area because especially when we're looking at the kinds of communications that ramp up very quickly, as you say, from telling a target you're very pretty or I'm sure you're very confident or something along the lines of a very flattering or complimentary kind of conversation, then quickly becomes, you know, if you trust me, if you like me, why don't you send me some information or why don't you send me a photo? And so then you have, as I say, you've got this kind of trap, right? So if that is something that the target gives up, then the next thing you know is that is being used to shame that particular minor to say, well, you know, you're the kind of person who has this kind of photo there of yourself that I now have. So in terms of how do you stop that, you know, one of the things that has to be done is parents have to talk to their kids about the fact that things like this could happen, right? If we imagine a real playground where there are lots of kids congregating and there are just a lot of adults milling about asking them a lot of questions and having conversations, parents would be unnerved by that and they would probably sit their kids down and say, don't have conversations with people like this. The problem with the virtual playground is that, of course, you don't know who's talking to your kids and you don't know what they're saying to them and you don't know if they're adults and you don't know if they're kids, and something that would sound incredibly suspicious coming from an adult would not sound so suspicious coming from a peer.
And one of the things too about, you know, being in these virtual worlds is that anonymity is huge, and players and a lot of people who play in these games, they love the anonymity, but of course that also gives predators the chance to hide. Are there conversations right now, whether statewide level, federal level, to force these games, these companies, to perhaps have a more rigorous identification process?
Well, there are a couple of challenges to that. There are certainly proposals of that nature, precisely because of the nature of this particular problem that is alarming the public. The problem is that there are pretty strong First Amendment protections for anonymous speech. And so any regulation that would seek to force platforms to not allow people to be anonymous online would run into some pretty serious constitutional challenges. And even if we're then appealing to these private companies to say, you know, forget about the law for a moment, just have a policy, because you're certainly entitled to have any policy you want about verification or anonymization, the legitimate concern there would be to say, lots of people who use our services, including minors, rely on that anonymity. If you have a kid who's wanting to talk about the fact that they're being abused at home, or if you have someone who's talking about his sexual orientation and isn't ready yet to come out and be identified, the practices that they're able to engage in under anonymity are very important. And so there are real trade-offs to taking a policy that says we're going to make it much harder for people to hide who they are online.
Now, there's the anonymity part, but the other part of it, too, is the fact that, again, information of a sexual nature, especially images, are being shared. What are these gaming companies doing in creating software that might at least catch some of these images to be able to stop that from happening?
So there is some good news on that front. There's some extremely sophisticated technology that was developed in collaboration with Microsoft. Dr. Hani Farid had helped create this product called PhotoDNA, which helps identify, for instance, child pornography images and makes it easier for that kind of image to be taken down quickly across platforms. And there's now evolutions of that product to apply it to videos and things of that nature. So when it comes to screening for sexually explicit imagery, you do actually see some good faith efforts and fairly sophisticated efforts on the part of some platforms to implement that kind of software and that kind of technology.
Is that information that can be taken down quickly or something that you probably want to share with law enforcement?
Well, there again, there are some difficulties. If something clearly seems to be child pornography, you would want to contact authorities, and actually service providers also have duties to report if they have actual knowledge that something is child pornography. But there's a lot of imagery that kind of comes into this gray space. For instance, if an adult is sending pictures of himself to a minor, it's difficult for a screening process to be able to detect what's wrong about that interaction, because unless you have all the information that it's an adult who's sending it to a minor and these are the circumstances under which that happened, it's not entirely clear to any kind of automated system what the problem is.
So then this might come back to this issue that you've brought up about, you know, First Amendment rights and the issue of anonymity. But again, you know, you take the playground, you know, metaphor. It's like playgrounds are meant for kids. And so if you see adults hanging out in playgrounds, you're going to step up and say something. You know, these games are sometimes meant for kids, and you think other kids are there hanging out. But now you have adults pretending to be kids hanging out with these children. Is that also a question of First Amendment rights, or can platforms say, you know what, we could set up a system where we can check age, your gender, criminal history, or anything, at least something, so we know who you are?
Well, these companies, it's important to assert that they have the right to do any of those things that you've just suggested. Any private company can take whatever safety measures it would like, essentially to say, we don't want people of this age, we don't want people of this particular who have criminal records. They could implement any of those policies if they so choose. The question is, what's their incentive for doing so? If you have a gaming platform or gaming product that not only minors use, but also adults like to use, and you set up situations where it's restricted, then you're obviously cutting into your bottom line. There, it becomes sort of a tension between whatever it is that your profit motive is actually telling you to do versus what the safety risks or the safety concerns might be. Which brings us back to the regulation question, which is, because of a very powerful law known as Section 230, these companies don't have much legal incentive to act against their profit interests, because they're largely protected from the kinds of things that happen on their platforms so long as they themselves are not directly producing the questionable content. So it really comes down to the question of what's going to make a company feel that it has any real reason to undertake these restrictive measures.
So basically, the company can't be targeted.
You can't in many cases. Now, if you can find a clear violation of federal criminal law, which includes things like child pornography and child exploitation, if you can show that there's actual knowledge of that, then that is one situation in which a company can't raise the defense of this law. But a lot of the other stuff, that is to say, you know, you've got third parties who are talking to other third parties on your platform, and you're not particularly screening it or monitoring it, you don't really know what they're up to, you don't have any actual knowledge, then you're not actually responsible for that, largely speaking, and you can't be sued as a company for that.
I'm talking with Marianne Frank. She's a professor at the University of Miami School of Law and president of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, a nonprofit group dedicated to combating online abuse. If you're a parent who's concerned about how much time your kid is spending online, and if it's safe, but also just what are you doing to help teach your kids about what to watch out for? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can also email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. Ms. Franks, is it difficult for parents to take criminal action? Let's say they find out that their child has been in contact, they could see the text thread. Really, what's the first step? What could they do?
I think the first step is to actually sit down with their child and try to figure out what's going on. A lot of these situations arise because these minors have not felt comfortable telling their parents what's happening, even when things start to become clearly wrong. And so the first thing, you know, in terms of whether it's online spaces or something else, whether it's bullying in schools or anything, the communication between children and their parents has to be open enough so that children trust their parents enough to tell them when something is happening, even if they feel embarrassed or ashamed of what they themselves might have done. It's that kind of sense of prohibition on their activity, the idea that they've done something to be ashamed of, that keeps them quiet. And so parents, first and foremost, really do need to have that conversation that says, look, even if you've done something that you're embarrassed about, or even if you've done something you're ashamed of, if someone's hurting you, if someone is making you feel very uncomfortable, you should tell me about it.
You know, I mean, I've read stories of people who get arrested and have been sent to prison, but I also get the sense that a lot of times the only way to catch the predator is, you know, is when they want to try to meet the child. Or, again, because it comes back to this anonymity, is it hard to find them online?
It can be extremely difficult. There is a real range of predation. There are people who are opportunistic exploiters, and so they do what's easy, and they don't necessarily take sophisticated measures to hide their identity. But then on the other hand, you also have pathological abusers who are very good at hiding their tracks. And because of the nature of the internet, it's extremely easy to stay anonymous if you want to stay anonymous.
I'm going to admit that I myself do not have kids, but my brother has three. And just, you know, two of them are always online. As much as my brother may try to keep an eye on them, it's difficult. You can't. You cannot watch everything they're doing. What do you say to parents about how to keep an eye on their kids' activity?
I think the first thing that's important is to acknowledge exactly what you've said, which is that parents cannot monitor their kids 24 hours a day, nor should they really want to, because kids also need privacy and they need to be able to develop their personalities away from their parents' gaze. So the one lesson really is that overarching idea of being able to say, you can talk to me if something is bothering you or if someone is hurting you, not specific to the internet, not specific to a game, but to be able to say, you have the right to tell someone to stop bothering you. You have the right to your own space. You have the right to your own body. You have the right to set boundaries for communications. Teaching your kids just healthy conceptual ideas about consent and about who owns their bodies is really important. But the other part of it is, I think we need to stop saying that it's the parent's responsibility, because we do know, of course, that it is impossible to monitor your kids 24/7. And the real problem here is that you have profit-making companies that are designed in ways that create these hazards, who are really the people who should be designing the safety features. And the fact of the matter is, if you don't have a product that can be used safely by minors, and you are soliciting minors, essentially, you're trying to get them to use your product, that ought to be your responsibility to come up with the best ways to keep children safe. So it isn't just up to the parents. I think the other part of what parents and everyone needs to do is to demand better from these companies, because they are really failing to protect the very people that they are attempting to have use their products.
This whole idea of sextortion is relatively new, considering that the technology really is relatively new still. These online chat rooms and our smartphones are really only within the last decade do we have these kind of capabilities. Does that, because it's still relatively new, are there enough mental health specialists who know how to help people with this sort of situation?
Well, in some ways, the problem of online exploitation is, like most other online problems, a very old story and a new story at the same time. The underlying problems and the underlying vulnerabilities are old. Kids want to be, they want to feel validated. Many kids are struggling with insecurities. Many kids feel isolated and they feel like they can't talk to their parents or to their peers. So they've always been vulnerable to an adult who might channel those kinds of anxieties and say, I alone understand you, or I know that you don't think that you're pretty, but I'm going to tell you that you are. These are age-old insecurities and anxieties that kids have always had. And so to the extent that you're able to have an environment at home where you teach your kids that they don't need to feel that way, that they don't have to, and to make them more resilient to those attempts to exploit their insecurities, that's something that is always a good plan. But it's certainly true, too, that technology just makes it so much easier for people with bad intentions to have access to really vulnerable kids. This is why I've said in the past that these virtual spaces are essentially hunting grounds, because you couldn't come up with a better tool for a predator than essentially an anonymous forum where a lot of kids hang out and talk about how much they don't like their themselves and how much they don't like their school. And you have people in the midst of that being able to listen in all of these conversations, discover all the weaknesses and anxieties of these kids and exploit them.
You know, I mean, you talked about what, you know, what responsibility the companies have. But I wonder, have you spoken with any of the industry leaders about how they view that, how they view their part in this issue?
There are many companies that, my organization works with who I would say there are certainly individuals at each of these major organizations, these companies that care very deeply about this issue and are very alarmed at how their platforms are being used. At the same time, individual good faith people at each organization or company is not enough to establish what the company is going to do or the practices it's going to undertake or the changes that it's going to make. And so I think what we haven't seen yet is a true institutional commitment or industry-wide commitment to saying this is actually our fault, as opposed to saying this is, oh, a misuse of our services. We're so sorry about that. And that's not unique to the online abuse phenomenon with minors, that there's a whole host of things that platforms and games are being used to accomplish or facilitate. So what we're really lacking, once again, is industry responsibility for this. But that's hardly surprising, because when you tell an industry, you're essentially unregulated, do it yourself, we're not going to allow anybody to sue you if you get it wrong. Well, this is exactly the kind of world you would get.
Where do you think this is all going? Because it seems like technology is changing faster than our laws, our legal system, even our social systems can keep up with.
Well, I think one of the things these kinds of crises allow us to consider is what are the mistakes we're making? And it has a lot to do with the idea of chasing down the crisis of the day and thinking, well, today there's a new problem that we have to race to catch up with. That is occasionally going to be true. But what is more often to, likely to be the case is there is an old problem that we have never sufficiently addressed. And it is now time that we think about what's actually at issue here. And one of the oldest problems when it comes to this particular issue is that you have to encourage responsible behavior on the part of powerful actors. The powerful actors today are tech companies. They are gaming platforms, and they have to be held responsible. We can't rely on their charity. We can't rely on their sudden, seizures of conscience. We actually have to say you have to be regulated just like any other industry. Because if we were to tell any other industry, you know, make as much profit as you want, roll out as many risky products as you feel like and just see what happens, and no one's ever going to get to sue you, we know what would happen in any other industry. So we need to think about the fact that we shouldn't have treated the internet and technology as this other thing that deserved all these special protections, because it doesn't deserve that. And we've seen what the consequences of being that deferential to the industry really are.
That was my conversation with Marianne Franks earlier today. She's a professor at the University of Miami School of Law, also the president of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, a nonprofit group dedicated to combating online abuse. Now, again, if you're a parent and you're concerned about how much time your kid's spending online and if it's safe, or, you know, maybe you found a way to watch over your kid, send us a note. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. Well, still to come, states are passing laws that extend the statute of limitations, helping victims of child sex abuse. More on that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. We are dedicating the full program today to the issue of child sex abuse. Now, before we get into the conversation, a reminder that the content we're talking about might be disturbing to some listeners. On Wednesday, a legislative House panel in Tallahassee unanimously approved a bill that would eliminate the statute of limitations for victims to initiate a criminal case against their abuser. This bill comes as states around the country have expanded the statute of limitations for civil cases involving victims of abuse. Jennifer Freeman is an attorney who represents victims of child sex abuse living in South Florida and New York. Her clients include victims of Jeffrey Epstein. She joins me in studio. Jennifer, thank you for the time.
Glad to be here and give some air to this very important issue.
Definitely. And also joining us from Tallahassee is attorney Catherine Robb. She is also the executive director of Child U.S. Advocacy. She's speaking with lawmakers this week about expanding the statute of limitations. Catherine, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
And Catherine, I want to start with you. What is the current statute of limitations in the state of Florida when we're talking about child sex abuse cases?
You know, Florida is not quite as bad as some other jurisdictions, although it can be a lot better. So essentially, for those sexual assaults that happen when the child is under age 16, there is no statute of limitations. And what we're trying to force legislators to do here in Tallahassee is to extend that and also offer window legislation or revival legislation. So, you know, as Jennifer can speak to, and as we all read, you know, unfortunately daily, victims like Epstein's victims, many of those victims were over 16. Lots of kids are molested and raped when they're over a day over 16, 17 and 18. So we're trying to pass and educate legislators to pass legislation that reflects the reality of what's happening out in the world to minors.
And you talked about, you know, we're not as bad as some states, but I mean, just to get an idea how we do compare to other states when it comes to this law.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this year in 2019 was an absolute banner year for statute of limitation reform for child sexual abuse. We had 41 jurisdictions introduce legislation, 25 passed legislation. Of those 25, there were 9 revival legislation, and of those 9, there are 8 windows. So, you know, big progress. I mean, the windows are really the type of legislation that allows us to identify hidden predators. And it's that type of legislation that we're really supporting, because when you identify hidden predators, you make children safer. So we're really pushing the legislation here to have window or revival legislation. So, you know, Florida has a long way to go.
And you mentioned windows a few times. I just want to make clear what you mean by that.
So essentially, it's a period of time created by law where previously barred claims under then existing statute of limitations is open. And, you know, New York just passed a 1-year window. Montana passed a 1-year window. Arizona passed a 19-month window. D.C. and New Jersey passed a 2-year window. We just had California pass another window, a 3-year window. So it opens up those a period of time where folks that were barred can go to court, go to someone like Jennifer Freeman, and file a claim, identify predators, and ultimately make kids safer.
Jennifer, she had mentioned this was a banner year nationwide. What do you think? What was it about this year that we saw a lot of states move forward on this?
It truly was a watershed year, a seismic shift in how people look at these child sex abuse issues and how to address them. I think one of the big reasons happened right here in South Florida, and that's the Epstein case. The incredibly in-depth and vigilant reporting by Julie Brown at the Miami Herald really opened that up. There were other kind of watershed issues like Dr. Nassar involving the Olympics, so the young girls that were abused there. There are so many other now examples, whether it's Jerry Sandusky or many others, and those just seem to come together to a tipping point, leading to something like the Child Victims Act in New York.
And yeah, because that was, Catherine mentioned that, again, this is where the Child Victims Act, it was passed. Just real quickly, explain the details of that act for folks who are not familiar with it.
Okay, this is very important for anyone who used to live in New York, let's say moved to Florida, retired down here as a transplant. Those people, if they were abused as a child in New York State, anywhere in New York State, have a 1-year opportunity to bring a claim. That 1 year has been ticking. So now they have less than 7 months, and they must pay attention to this. This is a very short window, a very short time frame in which they can come forward and bring their claim.
How many people have you met who are, you know, they understand that window is there and are coming forward? Have you spoken to anyone?
I mean, we've spoken to thousands of people at this point. We have now 800 clients.
Catherine, what about you? Have you also heard from folks knowing that that opportunity is now shrinking?
Well, as my role as the executive director here, you know, I'm not representing clients, but I hear from people all over the country and not just in New York about what can I do? Do I have rights here? I mean, it's every single day I get emails or calls from victims of child sexual abuse all over the country, including New York. It's an epidemic, which is why we need to have these laws.
And there are many other states that have passed these window legislations. So if you are mm-hmm. someone who has a child sex abuse claim when you were younger, check your state out. Okay, mm-hmm. New Jersey passed its window, 2-year window. California opened up its 3-year window. There are many other states, and there are many other states. Catherine and people like Catherine and I are working to change, including Florida.
You know, one of the critical challenges, as you both know, for victims of child sexual abuse is getting to that point where you feel comfortable to talk about it, to open up and share that story with people. What do we know from the research about individuals' ability to get to that point when they do? Is it a certain age, a certain point? Do they have to have many years pass before they can finally say, this happened to me, Jennifer?
The average age of a person to come forward, it's shocking perhaps, is age 52. So if we're thinking,
could be decades later.
Could be decades later. And there are so many reasons for this, whether it's fear, intimidation, psychological issues, depression, substance abuse, so many, many issues that could make someone not come forward.
Catherine, jump in, please.
Yeah, and I am a survivor of child sexual abuse, and Jennifer's right. The average age, the research, the data tells us that the average age is about age 52. I certainly didn't come out publicly and talk about it until I was in my 40s. There's a lot of shame involved. There's a lot of secrecy. Most children who are sexually abused, the data says about 90% know they're a predator. And so it's really hard to come forward and to, whether you're identifying a family member, a coach, a teacher, a clergy member, it's really difficult to sort of break through those boundaries where you're supposed to hold this person in high esteem. And that causes the delay.
One of the largest number of clients, we have approximately 250 clients with claims against one doctor at Rockefeller mm-hmm. University. And people don't necessarily think of their doctor as being a child sex abuser, but that happens as well.
Well, I think that was also brought up, as you said, with the Nassar case, a physical fitness trainer. I'm talking again with attorneys Jennifer Freeman and Catherine Robb. Robb is the executive director of Child U.S. Advocacy, which advocates for children's civil rights across the country. Freeman represents a number of victims of Jeffrey Epstein in New York and here in Florida. Speaking about Epstein, Epstein may be some of the higher profile names in these cases, but the Child Victims Act is also being used against institutions like the Boy Scouts of America and the Catholic Church. Catherine, what have been the challenges thus far in taking these kind of institutions, into civil cases?
Yeah, excellent question, Lewis. This has been an enormous battle fighting these big institutions, especially the Catholic Church. I mean, in New York, it was a David and Goliath win for us. I mean, I spent 12 years working with other great advocates in New York and great legislatures there. It was a battle because they put millions of dollars into lobbying efforts to kill these bills. It's interesting. I was struck by what Marianne Frank just said about, this is a problem we haven't addressed and we really have to make these companies accountable. It's really the same thing. It doesn't matter if the institution is putting out a risky product or if they're putting out predators out there and not warning the public and not being accountable with their hiring and firing and training and reporting and all of that. It's the same type of thing that we really have to make laws that put these big companies and institutions to make them accountable for what they're doing. It's been a big battle, but there are a lot of brave advocates out there that are fighting every day on this across the country.
And I mean, just as a note, I have to reach out to the Boy Scouts of America and the Catholic Church to see what they'd have to say on that. But they have lobbied against legislation in New York and Florida.
Heavily.
Okay.
And that's now happening in Florida. As we try to open up Florida, its own window or revival legislation, we're finding that the insurance companies once again are coming forward to try to stop us.
Jennifer, by the way, I wondered if when you deal with an institution compared to an individual like Epstein, Epstein was a very powerful man with a lot of resources, but I don't know if that changes the dichotomy of trying to deal with these cases, dealing with an individual compared to a large group.
That can be quite different because unfortunately, and we're finding this in New York, when you're dealing with an individual, the resources typically are not there as well as they might be for a Jeffrey Epstein or an institution. And that's a problem. We're trying to address that a different way.
Catherine, as I mentioned, you are in Tallahassee. You're meeting with lawmakers. We're underway now in session, considering these proposals to expand the statute. Katrina Dusterhaus had come forward. She lives here in Florida. She had a compelling story about her high school experience. She was gang raped when she was 17
right.
years old. She's 34 now. She's seeking justice. Again, proposing legislation that could be helpful to her and others in the situation. Right now, what do you see and hear from lawmakers? Are they open to listening to these stories? What are you getting a sense of?
I think by and large they are, and I think Senator Lauren Book is really committed and passionate about these issues, really want to put forward some legislation that can respond to this epidemic that, of course, is affecting folks in Florida as well as all over the country. In Florida, we might have another issue, and that issue is the constitutionality of retroactive legislation. And many jurisdictions are tackling this additional issue by seeking constitutional amendments, which may very well, in fact, have to happen here in Florida because of the law of a vested property right in defendants in the statute of limitations. So it's sort of another issue. Each state is different. Each state has different case law in terms of constitutionality. Each state has a different constitution. The very language of their constitutions can be different. But, all of them can be met with either amendments or strong legislation that can tackle this problem. And one would be a referendum here in Florida to amend the Constitution and allow these claims to be retroactive, these claims to be brought through retroactivity.
Yeah. And you mentioned Senator Lauren Book, she's a Democrat from Broward County. I'm speaking with attorneys Jennifer Freeman and Catherine Robb. Again, today we're focusing the entire program on the issue of child sex abuse, the threats that children face online, and the fight to expand the statute of limitations in many of these cases. We're going to take a break, come back, and we're going to continue this conversation and get an update on the Jeffrey Epstein case. All next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Today's program, again, focused on the issues of child sex abuse. And before we get into the conversation, again, a reminder that the content we're talking about here might be disturbing to some listeners. I'm talking with attorney Catherine Robb, Executive Director of Child U.S. Advocacy. She's in Tallahassee. Also joining me in studio is Jennifer Freeman. Freeman's clients include victims of Jeffrey Epstein. Yesterday, Denise George, Attorney General of the U.S. Virgin Islands, filed a lawsuit arguing that Epstein continued to sexually abuse girls as recently as 2018. Jennifer, we were aware of the abuse committed by Epstein in New York and Florida, but what are these latest findings by the U.S. Virgin Islands mean for the civil case against his estate?
Well, what the Attorney General is trying to do is she's bringing a essentially a RICO, a racketeering claim against the estate and seeking basically to confiscate his properties there. And this would add to the estate. And the question is, who gets the resources in the estate after that? And that's still an open question.
Because these crimes are allegedly committed, you know, on a U.S. territory, they still fall under the statute of limitations?
Each state and the territory as well have their own statute of limitations. This is generally a state issue, child sex abuse. It's not a federal claim like trafficking, for example. That could be a different kind of statute. So when you are seeking claims under this kind of a statute, you may be looking at state law as well.
What are your clients here in New York also pursuing from the Epstein estate at this juncture?
Well, many of the Epstein clients are seeking some kind of accountability, responsibility, and justice. And unfortunately, the only justice we have, particularly when it comes to Epstein, who's no longer with us, it was such a tragic death, not for so many reasons, and to the victims felt so close to having someone to actually hold responsible. But this is something that it's been a very challenging thing for victims. They want some kind of response.
Because he's dead, how does that change your fight?
Well, many of the victims feel that being able to confront their abuser is a very significant part of their justice and their healing. So that's why the death was so tragic and the surprising death. I mean, there's been all kinds of speculation, as you know, about whether that truly was a suicide or a murder.
Catherine, I mean, when you talk about the victims, Epstein's victims, you're talking about crimes from 10 to 20 years ago. If the Florida legislature is successful in expanding the statute of limitations, what would that mean for women abused by Epstein at his Palm Beach County estate?
Well, it would mean, like Jennifer just said, that they would have an opportunity to have some justice and some healing and some accountability. I think it would go a very long way towards making many of those victims have some significant healing.
I wonder when you think about these crimes, this is not new. It's been around a long time, but I think a lot is changing now. And I wonder how much of it is the Epstein case. You have the Weinstein case. You have a lot of big profile cases over the last few years popping up. Do you think this is the reason why we're starting to see a movement change?
Absolutely. I think it is a movement. It, you know, we call it a civil rights movement for children. I think the Me Too movement has a lot to do with it. And I think it's, you know, these dirty secrets are very hard to talk about. You know, people don't want to talk about sex abuse of children. It's difficult. It's yucky. It's uncomfortable. And I think that when you sort of make that crack in the system and slowly people start to speak and are brave and come forward, it speeds up that process. You know, whether it's Sandusky or Nassar or Epstein or Weinstein or clergy or doctors, you know, the more people speak and quite frankly, Lewis, the more we get people in the press to speak, the better it's going to be for children across the country.
Catherine, as you said, you have a personal story for you, and you know, you didn't talk about it for a long time. Just thinking about how everything has played out, what would you have done differently? Do you think you could help somebody who was in your situation, you know, have that courage to speak up sooner? What would you do? What would you tell them?
Well, the reason I speak out every single day and speak to press like I'm doing so here is because I know that there are so many children out there that don't have a voice right now. And I know that there are lots of adults out there that are so in such deep and unspeakable pain that they also can't speak. And I feel like it is my obligation and duty as a human being on this planet to help prevent more harm. And the more I speak, hopefully the more other people will have the courage to come up and come out and speak as well.
Again, we spent this entire show today talking about the issue of child sex abuse, and right now I'm speaking with attorneys Jennifer Freeman and Catherine Robb. Jennifer, I want to come back to what we were talking about earlier, with clients here in South Florida who need to know that there is a window here if they were victims of child sex abuse crimes when they lived in New York. And so, again, because you represent a number of these clients, a lot of transplants have moved down here, and they may not know about the Child Victims Act. And again, they have a limited amount of time. So this, again, at any point in their lives, if they were victims of child sex abuse, now is the time to speak up. You've spoken to a lot of people, but a lot of people are surprised that this even exists.
I understand that, which is one of the reasons Catherine and I are speaking out, is to make sure that there is some knowledge. And people can then make their own choice whether they want to come forward, but we want to give them at least the information so that they can make an informed choice. The other thing I wanted to just focus on or just point out to you, Lewis, for just a second, is that a lot of people want, what they really want, is they want a lot of victims really to hold the perpetrators criminally responsible. But that's no longer an option. That's not an option because you can't go back, you can't revive those statutes of limitations. That's unconstitutional to be retroactive like that. So all they really have are these civil claims. That's their path to justice.
If you have, and I don't know, maybe you've had some clients who perhaps are dealing with a crime that happened a long time ago. And as you said, I mean, they can't anyway, but that person perhaps is gone. How do you help somebody find closure?
This is one of the paths, is to actually hold the institution or the person responsible for what happened. And very often there are institutional issues here because the institution failed to protect the children. The Catholic Church transferred priests around and around and around, knowing that those priests were abusers. They failed to protect the children. The Boy Scouts did some of the same thing. And there are files out there in their own files, referred to as perversion files or the secret files, which contain a lot of this information. This must come out.
Catherine, just to finish up again, you're in Tallahassee working with lawmakers. The session just started, but what's next for you? I don't know if you have perhaps meetings coming up with people. Will you get the chance to talk to the governor, perhaps?
I would love the opportunity to talk to the governor and get the full might of the governor's office behind this and really putting children first and foremost and, you know, protecting from these institutions that cover up and these, monsters out there like Epstein that abuse young children. I would love that opportunity.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Freeman and Catherine Robb. Robb is the executive director of Child U.S. Advocacy, which advocates for children's civil rights across the country and is focused on expanding the statute of limitations for child sex abuse cases. Freeman represents a number of victims of Jeffrey Epstein in New York who are using the Child Victims Act to pursue charges against his estate. Both of you, thank you so much for the time and sharing with us.
Good to be
thank
with you.
Thank you, Lewis.
And that is our program for this Thursday, January 16th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapkin. Our technical supervisor is Peter J. Merritt. Now, coming up next week on Sundial, we have a special program for Martin Luther King Day. You're going to hear our conversation with renowned historian Dr. Anine Pinkney from the historic Hampton House. You'll also hear about Dr. King's time in Miami and how he wrote his I Have a Dream speech here in South Florida. Plus, the play American Son is now at the Arts Center in downtown Miami. American Son tells the story of an interracial couple at a Miami police station awaiting the news of their son who was involved in an incident. A reminder, we are reading Mothers of Sparta by Fort Lauderdale author Dawn Davies. Head to Facebook, join our book club, search Sundial Book Club. There you can find our recent conversation with Dawn. It was fascinating. We'll be announcing next month's book pretty soon, so just go there to get all the details, and we'd love to hear what you think. Have a wonderful Friday. Have a great weekend. Again, for Monday, it's a holiday. Take care of yourself. Be safe. We'll talk to you again soon.